Well, we've got lots to talk about today.
you're not even going to let me talk about it?
Yeah, okay, go on then, talk about it.
I'm going to start this again. I feel like we've made too many jokes about the zone of interest. Hold on.
No, I don't. Don't listen. Just because the topic's the Holocaust doesn't mean we can't like laugh about the way to get there to you watching it.
Of course, I agree with that. But I don't feel funny about it, though. You know, I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Okay, great. And then that's the segue. Now tell us how serious you feel about it.
I feel really seriously about it. Okay. No, I don't feel really seriously about it. I feel like it's not a laughing matter.
Of course it's not. The release of this film and me not going to see it has really underlined how I can't consider myself a real film fan anymore.
Right.
Because I'm not going to see it.
You've made that decision.
Well, you know how you didn't open the door or close the door to Tom Cruise?
Yeah.
You know, the door was never open.
Yeah.
In the same sort of way, the door was...
What's the door to?
To this film and what it's...
Just specifically this film?
No, and any films of its ilk and like that. It's obviously very important. Everyone has given it nothing but 5 stars.
Should we say for anyone listening who doesn't know what the film is, The Zone of Interest is the story of the Nazi family, the father of whom runs Auschwitz, and it's all from the perspective of that family. That's what the film is about. So carry on, Adam.
Directed by Jonathan Glazer of Under the Skin fame. The best film that I will never see again.
Yeah, I feel the same about The Zone of Interest. It's quite under the skinny, by the way.
Under the skinny.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's more just I've got no place to be doing a film podcast. I've got no place to be speaking about film.
Right.
Because I'm not going to see this film.
Yeah.
I'm old and the door's closed to certain things.
Right. Let's dig into this, though. What is it about this film that makes you think the door's closed for you? I understand. I'm not judging that, by the way. I'll never watch Marriage Story, right?
There you go. Yeah, so
like,
you get
I understand.
It.
I do get it. And it's not, it doesn't, that's not saying anything about Marriage Story. I just won't ever watch it. I've decided. So what is it about The Zone of Interest that has made you decide that you're never going to watch it? Because you love Under the Skin.
I do, and I love the director. So the majority of it is the narrative around it, the critical narrative.
Oh, you've got Oscar'd.
No, it's even pre-Oscar'd. It was all, you know, when people are saying the most important film of a generation.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I just think, fuck off.
That is a really bad thing.
To who? Yeah, to you. Anyone who says that, they just like a paid critic. I mean,
sure.
They're all just trying to cast themselves into the story.
Yeah.
Of the film, like, oh, I've spotted it. I've spotted the film of a generation, the most important work of art of our time.
Yeah.
You know what? I won't never watch it. I'll watch it.
No, sure. You'll wait for that.
In 10 years, I've got to wait the ten. I've got to wait the 10 years. But then you've snuck in it. You've snuck it in. I'm really jealous.
I've snuck it in, but I totally get what you're saying because I went to see this in the cinema with my wife, 11 a.m. Sunday morning. Oh. Yeah, we leave the cinema in silence, obviously, and then we tried to talk about it, and then we both agree that it almost feels offensive to discuss it. It's a film where it feels as though it would be wrong to even offer any critical analysis, even just in a private conversation.
Right.
What I will say, forgetting about the topic, the subject matter. The filmmaking is very impressive, and I'm surprised that a film like this about that exists in the way that it does, so I can see why it struck a chord with people. It's a very good film. I will never watch it again.
Hello, and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond. This is the show in which we chat about the films we forgot we'd even seen in the first place. Joining me as ever is the old leaky bucket brain, Joe Devine.
That was ever so slightly more beleaguered than normal weeks. Are you tired?
Yeah, I am quite tired. My wife left me.
Oh.
With one of my children. And we're talking on Sunday night. She left me on Friday. She left me on Friday and ruined my weekend. You're doing my best friend. That's a bit Shed Seven for you. Sorry. I don't know how that happened.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You're becoming a jovial broadcaster. She's coming back, right?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, was that not implied?
No.
She will return.
Yeah.
She'll return tomorrow. They had a long weekend holiday together.
Right.
And I was left at home to look after our 3-year-old.
Sure.
Who likes to wake up at 5:30 in the morning.
Right.
But he's a good lad. And he's very easygoing, and it's been lovely. It's been fine. I can do it. It's just long days, man. Long days. On today's episode, it's a very special, different kind of episode.
Dublo, dublo.
It's a double header, and it all came out. It all came up. Because the first film, the film that I got Joe on, was the 2005 Sam Mendes directed flick Jarhead,
mm-hmm.
which stars Jake Gyllenhaal.
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 Yeah.
Gyllenhaal.
Gyllenhaal.
Now, I'm not going to do the full Letterboxd or rundown because
okay.
off the back of that, I threw in The Hurt Locker, which is the 2008 Catherine Bigelow directed flick starring Jeremy Renner.
Best Picture Oscar winner.
Yeah, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. They are both very much of they're brothers in arms. Jarhead is set during the Gulf War in the 1990s.
Yeah, 1991.
And Hurt Locker is later, and it is around the Iraq War. Now, I've wanted to do Hurt Locker for a while. Joe laughed at me. This could be an episode where I get my pants pulled down. The reason we're going to talk about them together is that they are Iraq war films.
Mm-hmm. Technically, yes.
And we're going to open that up to talk generally first about what they are and how they've changed. We might do a little bit of compare and contrasting, and then we're going to go into the individual movies. Mm. So that's the most heavily structured plan we've ever had.
Let's watch it fall to pot.
Now, Joe, this is going to be a packed episode.
Yeah.
And so this is what I know. You know more about the history of these conflicts and history in general. You know more than me.
Right.
So I'm going to try and give you lots of space.
Okay.
I'm going to try and not speak over you.
Sure.
That's what my goal is.
Okay.
But also, you need to then know that I know more about the movies that were set around this time.
Yeah, okay.
So you're going to then have to give me some space.
Sure, sure.
I think the goal for this episode is space.
Yeah, that's very big of you.
Go on, you whack the ball.
The place to start for me would be to think about what Second World War films and Vietnam films, what they represent and how they have their own genres, right? Because in a sense, those films reflect the way that America felt about those wars at the time, and films that were made more recently, how America feels about those wars now. So the themes of most American World War II films are individual heroes, duty, camaraderie, and average guys that were drafted and sent to go and fight. So you're thinking of Saving Private Ryan, for example. It's, you know, the famous kind of bit throughout that film is that the whole way through, Tom Hanks's crew are trying to guess what he did for a job back home. Eventually he tells them he was a school teacher. No one can believe it, right? These were average, ordinary people who were drafted to go and fight. And the stories tend to be about a mixture of them fulfilling their duty on behalf of their country and a level of patriotism, but mostly about them wanting not to be there and wanting to go home.
So you're talking mainly about modern, more modern World War II American...
Yeah, like more modern World War II American films, but also even films of the 60s and 70s as well. You kind of have to go like back to the First World War. You watch those old British movies of the First World War. Those are the last ones where you really get like that full on kind of propaganda. Feels like a very strong word to apply to it, but that very kind of like victory, you know, public moral spirit kind of approach to making these films, where it's all about totally winning one over against the enemy. World War II films, you start to see a kind of appreciation of the complexity of war, but it's still largely about duty and patriotism and getting your average guys back home.
Not entirely. You've also got films like Dirty Dozen and The Eagle Has Landed. I think you've also got it's used as a fun, capery backdrop film. So even like Indiana Jones, when you've got the Nazis as the bad guys, the simplicity of that war of goodies versus baddies opens it up to other genres.
Well, absolutely, helped by the fact that the Nazi ruling elite seem legitimately evil, and World War II is seen as one of those wars which is the most cut, you know, one of the most cut and dry, which is what lays the groundwork for all of those sorts of films. Move, and also that reflects the way that America and Americans feel about the war at the time, which is that it was a huge victory. They felt very patriotic about it. They felt as though they did play a crucial role in ending that war. Move on to the Vietnam War, which is, you know, 2.5 decades later. The US people do not feel the same way as a whole about US involvement in that war. And as a reflection of that, Vietnam movies, Adam, are, you know, US troops are often seen as the antagonists. There's lots of exploration of conspiracy. There's the introduction of moral ambiguity. That rings true to you based on the Vietnam films that you've seen, right? They're very different to World War II films.
They are. You've got Oliver Stone's Platoon, which I think is I know everyone talks about Apocalypse Now, but the film that speaks to that cynicism and sadness and sense of betrayal that like the soldiers felt about Vietnam, it's Platoon that does that. Whereas Apocalypse Now and The Deer Hunter, they are more, I guess they're more like psychological.
Yeah.
Yeah, the psychological turmoil that men go through. And Vietnam is, Vietnam is very much the backdrop for that.
And many of the Vietnam War films also directly or indirectly question the purpose of the troops being there, right? That's something which, again, is a little different to most classic World War II films. That's a little more cut and dry. Those films don't feel that they need to deal in that question at all, whereas like there are a number of Vietnam movies that deal directly with the idea of whether or not America should even have been there. And I think that's a key thing that sets them apart. And then if you move into Iraq films, and to discuss the notion of whether there even is a genre for Iraq war movies, there are a few different points that I think make these films different to those that came before.
There's genres within genres
in this
next thing, but go on, hit me.
The first, the really simple one, there was no draft, okay? For World War II, for the Vietnam War, there was conscription in America, which meant that many of the soldiers that were going to fight did not volunteer to fight. They were your average working class folks. All they wanted to do, maybe do their duty, definitely get home alive. Okay. For the Iraq War and for the Gulf War, there was no draft. So the soldiers being sent to go and fight, they were already a military class. And therefore, many Iraq war movies focus on specialists within the army or within the Marines. So Jarhead is a great example of that, because it's, Jake Gyllenhaal is a Marine stroker sniper. In The Hurt Locker, obviously Jeremy Renner is a bomb disposal expert. And there are loads of other examples of films that fit the genre like that.
I think you're slightly wrong. I know later on you get specialists. I think there's technically not a draft, but yeah, like there's economic factors, like in the what else are they going to do?
Well, there's a sense of patriotism and belief in the propaganda about war as well. But I think that makes a difference, because then the characters that you're watching, when you do watch a professional, yes, they still deal in some of the same themes, you know, the question of whether they want to be there or not, whether they want to go home, whether they can go home. But you are inherently, you're watching someone who has, to a certain degree, and I do agree with you about the context, it could never be this clear cut, chosen to be there. And secondly, you're watching characters who are at the top of their game and who are absolute elite superheroes at what they do, which is not what you were watching in most World War II and Vietnam films. You're watching ordinary people in horrible situations.
And I think that speaks to less the war, and maybe you meant this, but it speaks more to the tastes of Hollywood,
yeah,
and the kinds of films that get made.
Yeah.
And the kinds of characters that people want to see.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, Hurt Locker, we're going to get onto this. As good as it is, and I really liked it, it's guilty of making its heroes, not they're action heroes.
Yeah.
It's basically Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
It's got the Lethal Weapon chalk and cheese type thing.
I think go there now. I think it's cool to discuss this now.
Well, yeah. It's annoying because I did really enjoy it. I haven't gone on record as said. I've said I like it. I liked it a lot. It's got some fantastic moments.
It's a very, very watchable film.
Very watchable. Yeah. But what I found interesting is it managed to blend a very gritty war film, doesn't pull its punches, but then at the same time, it's got a lot of Hollywood tropes.
And the chalk and cheese thing you're referring to, that's between Jeremy Renner, the protagonist, and then Anthony Mackie, who's the staff sergeant, right?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, we haven't, because I haven't done a letterboxed, so haven't spoken to who's in it and who is chalk and who is cheese. But yeah, Jeremy Renner in Hurt Locker is the mad, crazy maverick who plays by his own rules.
He's cheese, or is he chalk? No, he's chalk, right?
I'd say he's cheese, because cheese is stinky and fun,
right,
and chalk is stiff,
right,
and functional and plays it by the book.
Yeah.
And that's Mackie all over.
Yeah.
And man, I tell you what, isn't it an absolute crying shame that these two guys just got dumped in the Marvel bin,
sure,
and like spent the rest of their careers
as Marvel B-listers?
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree for sure. They're a terrific match in this, a pairing in this film. And what Anthony Mackie does really well, his character is, you know, the opening scene of the film, you see him and his colleague working with Guy Pearce. And Guy Pearce, who you sent me a text after watching the film saying, I want to see this film, the version of this with just Guy Pearce in it. I agree.
It's such a great fake out.
Yeah, it's really good.
Pearce is an actor of such heft,
yeah,
that you think he's going to be around for a while. If I'd seen this, I can't remember seeing this at the cinema. I would have seen it at the cinema and I would have known that Guy Pearce wasn't the star.
Mm.
But I don't think I would have necessarily thought, oh, yeah, he's not long for this world.
Yeah.
Easily, it could have easily been Mackie.
Well, this is the thing. Guy Pearce dies in the first scene and then he's replaced in his mini team by Jeremy Renner, which starts this kind of chalk and cheese relationship between Renner and Mackie.
And it also beautifully sets the stakes for the movie.
Yeah.
Also, for a Hollywood action movie, this is where explosions matter.
Yeah.
You cannot run away from an explosion.
No.
For a laugh.
No.
And it looked cool. It really delivers that if you're anywhere near a blast,
yeah,
you could die.
Well, I mean, and the inside of Guy Pearce's head hitting the front of the screen and the inside of his helmet is a perfect vision of that.
And it's that kind of detail and lovely touch, because people are inured to explosions now.
Yeah.
A guy running away from an explosion in an action movie is a huge trope, and you're fine. You dust the glass off you.
Yeah.
But Hurt Locker does a fantastic job of saying, no. There's a blast radius, and if you're anywhere in it, you know, you could be fucked.
Yeah. Yeah. But the thing that one other thing I would add while we're on Hurt Locker, I forget every time I watch this that Ralph Fiennes shows up halfway through playing a British sort of... It's unclear whether he's a British Secret Service agent or whether he's a hired hand, right? He's private military.
He's a contract. He's a dodgy guy. Again, this is why I can believe it to be a forgot film, because I'm thinking, oh, there's Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah. No, that's true. Anyway, point is, I really want to see the whole film of Ralph Fiennes as the contract killer, the dodgy guy.
That brings to mind again the problem with the Hurt Locker, as realistic as it pertains to be. Mm-hmm. And what I loved about it was it's so procedural.
Yeah.
It's so much about the nuts and bolts of what it's like to be not just a bomb disposal expert, but, well, I don't know, they're not Marines. What are they? Are they Marines? Army guys.
Army guys, I think they're just army guys.
It kind of digs into what do they have to do, you know, to clear a street and all that kind of stuff. I love that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But when they meet Ralph Fiennes, and I won't say what happens, but then they're pinned down.
Sure.
And these guys are bomb disposal experts, right?
Yes.
But then the film says, no, mate, these guys are shit hot.
They're super soldiers.
Wait a minute. They're also really good at snipering.
Yeah.
It's these kinds of things where I see why this film was so successful.
Yeah. Well, you root for them. You want them to win.
It's unsatisfactory, and yet it makes the film entertaining.
Yeah, I agree. I think, well, listen, I was tempted to talk about the ending of The Hurt Locker, but I think maybe we should save that for point two. Because point two, about in the list of subject... In the list of...
What was point one? Oh, yeah. We were talking about experts.
Point one was there was no draft, yeah? Point two in the subheadings of Iraq war film genre is trauma, mental health, yeah? The thing that the Iraq films do more so... I mean, this started to happen in Vietnam films, but the things that the Iraq films do is... Born on the 4th of July. They start to explore... the idea that people's mental health might be impacted by going to war. So there's a lot about PTSD and there's a lot about the idea of a soldier not being able to reacclimatize to their home life, never being able to go back once they've seen the horrors of war. And I think, to be fair, that is because that is directly related to what happened with Vietnam, where many, many drafted soldiers came home to no acclaim because the US public at large didn't support the war effort. Many, were left on the streets, and ex-military homelessness became an absolutely enormous issue. Loads of people with PTSD, completely untreated. Everyone knew about that by the time Iraq war films were being made. So it's unsurprising that it became one of the central themes explored. And that kind of happens in The Hurt Locker, not as much as some other Iraq war films, though.
They don't ever say PTSD.
No, no.
And they don't really deal with it in The Hurt Locker. It's very much in Jarhead, the suffering and what it does to a man. Jake Gyllenhaal does a good guy losing it. You can see he's doing Nightcrawler stuff.
Sure.
Kind of screaming and losing his mind.
Yeah.
I think, you know, there are depths to Jarhead that there aren't to The Hurt Locker.
Sure.
In that regard.
Yeah, well, Peter Sarsgaard also, great performance in that regard. Peter Sarsgaard Rhymes. In that regard.
yeah.
This is where I think we differ a little bit, though. And maybe this is the first compare and contrast between Jarhead and The Hurt Locker, because I think The Hurt Locker deals with this quite well, albeit subtly.
It might touch on what war does to someone. But Jarhead, it digs in, the whole film, it really digs into that. And it the whole film is about that. And it's about, and it's also the heart, the really interesting conflict about men who are trained and jazzed up to send out to go and kill people.
Yeah.
Who are then denied to do that at every opportunity. It's a far more interesting conceit,
sure,
a more powerful conceit than The Hurt Locker.
Yeah, I think the conceit is better.
I'm not saying that doesn't make it a better film.
Yeah.
I'm just saying
I agree with you.
I'm just going to compare and contrast different little elements.
Well, why don't you now introduce the Jarhead, because we've done that for The Hurt Locker, but we haven't really told listeners, if they haven't seen Jarhead, what it's about.
Oh, I haven't done the letterbox. Let me do the letterbox for Jarhead.
Yeah.
It's the Jarhead 2005 Sam Mendes directed film based on the novel of the same name by Anthony Swofford. It's called, I mean, the film's called Jarhead. It's not called Anthony Swofford. And here's the letterboxed. Welcome to the suck.
Is that spelled S-U-K-C? C-K? I never understand that bit.
Well, like, it sucks.
Is that what? Is that all it means?
Yeah.
Oh.
Welcome to the suck. It sucks.
Right. So, like, right.
Jarhead is a film about a US Marine's experience in the Gulf War. After putting up with an arduous boot camp, and that's saying something, Swofford and his unit are sent to the Persian Gulf where they are eager to fight, but are forced to stay back from the action. Swofford struggles with the possibility of his girlfriend cheating on him, and as his mental state deteriorates, his desire to kill increases. That's an appalling summary of a very good film. Yeah, it also stars Peter Sarsgaard, as mentioned.
Yeah.
And it's lensed by Roger Deakins, Coen Brothers cinematographer. And I've lost my train of thought now that I had to introduce Jarhead.
You're introducing Jarhead because we were going to talk about trauma and how the impact on the soldier is explored in these films.
Right. Yeah. So Jarhead is particularly about that, I would say. It's about the boredom. It's brutal. It's far more brutal than The Hurt Locker. About, like, it has Full Metal Jacket vibes about the hazing and the experience of being a grunt in the suck.
Yes.
And it's about the camaraderie also. The Hurt Locker is far more action movie oriented, and it doesn't, the only thing it really speaks to in terms of like a internal struggle is Jeremy Renner's need for thrills.
Yeah.
And how he puts other people's lives on the line. That isn't particular to the Iraq War or PTSD. That's particular to his character.
Yeah.
He's basically Riggs from Lethal Weapon.
Sure.
So it's a really modern action movie character in a more realistic setting. And it's interesting. It's a fun little clash. But that makes Jarhead, to my mind, a more authentic and powerful film. Not better.
Sure.
Not saying better yet.
Yeah.
I'm saying just about something a little bit more meaningful.
I think I agree with you. What I will say in favour of The Hurt Locker is its focus is more narrow, and it's, you know, the kind of the central struggle for Jeremy Renner, the protagonist in this film, is the notion of being unable to let go of the adrenaline that he's found by disposing of these bombs in these very high pressure situations. So there's a lovely scene towards the end of the film, which when I first saw the movie, I just assumed was the ending. And it turns out that it isn't. When we cut from Jeremy Renner having like a very intense situation in Iraq, and then bash, cut straight back home. He's in a supermarket with his wife, and he's in the cereal aisle, and he's just looking up and down the aisle at the you know, huge numbers of cereal boxes. It's the perfect ending for the film. The film then goes on for another 10 minutes and that kind of fucks up itself a little bit, I think.
But the end, that end is about, is a nice little cynical, like, is that what the war was for? That's about choice. It is about him returning to his bland, dull life. But he's particularly he's stuck in an American supermarket with 50 different types of cereal. So the film is posing the question, is this what I fought my war for? Now I would ask you, you just said that it speaks to him like battling his need for adrenaline. When, aside from the end, that doesn't count, when in the film, in the meat of the film, does he ever question that, or is it ever a problem for him?
When does he question his need for adrenaline?
Yeah, and when does he ever struggle with that? And when is he ever unsure about that? And when is it ever a problem for him?
I mean, I'm not sure. Yeah, okay, but I think you've framed it in a way that's making me unable to make the point that I want to make. Like,
you could make a different one.
What you've done is you've expertly asked me a question which I can't answer. You know I can't, and therefore what you think is correct. Can I just?
No,
I make my point? I introduced the notion of the ending, I would like to explain why I think that would be a good ending, and it's about more than just the point of.
Okay,
I know it's not the ending. I'm just saying. I think it would make an excellent ending. I also think that the quick cut from being there to being at home, it's not just questioning whether he ever should have been there in the first place. The whole tone, the whole experience, the whole feeling of that quick cut between those two places. There's no traveling home. There's no letter to say I'm coming home soon. There's no countdown to the number of days where he's going home, right? He's just home all of a sudden, and in the most boring and kind of meaningless and bleak and consumerist possible place.
And yeah, I think Jarhead does exactly the same cut.
It does. It's good. That cut, I think, as it is in Jarhead, is about more than just the question of whether or not he should have been there. I think that switch shows this character who, over the last hour and a half, we've come to learn what he's capable of, how he's capable of holding himself in these high-pressure situations. And then all of a sudden, he's in an entirely different environment. It's very obvious to me what kind of impact that's going to have on this guy who I've come to learn about. You know, there are scenes along the way where there's a scene, for example, where he calls his wife, played by Evangeline Lilly, back at home. She answers the phone. He doesn't say anything. She knows it's him. She asks, you know, him to speak. He doesn't say anything. He can't speak to her because he knows that he has to stay in the headspace that he's in to be successful where he's in war.
But this doesn't speak at all to him being an adrenaline junkie, which is what the text of the film is. Also, the cut is amazing, phenomenal. That cut is better than any cut in Jarhead. There is then also a subsequent 10 minutes of him with his family, him talking to his baby, and a hugely trite scene. And then the film, The Hurt Locker, finishes with him triumphantly returning to war over action music. So
I think that's heavily laced with irony, by the way, the ending.
You could argue that.
And I do. And this is the point. This is where I think these films are different.
It basically allows you to read it both ways. It allows you to be a flag-waving American, or you can then go, you can put on your cynical hat and go, oh yeah, no, it was being ironic. And I think that's a bit of a cop-out. Now you go.
The key difference, I think, between these two films, and I think it is a viewer difference. I'm saying you and me. In Hurt Locker, you talk about the adrenaline junkie context within the text, what characters are saying to each other, yeah? When I watch a film, I don't rely on what characters are saying to each other to tell me what the film is about. In Jarhead, all the characters tell me what the film is about. Whereas when I watch Hurt Locker, I think that the loud rock music at the end is deeply ironic. I think that whilst there are scenes of characters talking directly about Jeremy Renner's adrenaline addiction and his need for the thrill, there is no direct textual acknowledgement of any deeper mental health problem going on as a result of being in this situation, which when I watch the film, I feel is obviously present. The characters in the film don't tell me that it's there, but they do in Jarhead. And I think that's what makes these two films different.
I can see how you could appreciate Hurt Locker on that basis. I was going to say, oh, you know, I think you're giving it too much credit. But you're in this instance, I don't think I could say that, because it is a good enough film. And there is, it is probably there. And that's fine. I think the reason characters in Jarhead, to push back on that, the reason that characters in Jarhead make stuff part of the text is because it's based on a guy's memoir.
Where it's in the
first
text,
person,
yeah.
And it is in the yeah. text, and it's more poetic. And so, yeah. Say, the end of Jarhead, we just talked about the end of Hurt Locker, the end of Jarhead is Jake Gyllenhaal's voiceover, and it's wonderfully poetic and sad. It does effectively tell you what the film's been about.
Sure.
But in a wonderfully lyrical, mournful and beautiful way. Yeah. And there's a wonderful hazy shot of the guys walking in the haze of the desert.
We're all still in the desert.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Now, that ending is better than the ending of The Hurt Locker, but the scene that is the finale of The Hurt Locker, the suicide, there's a suicide bomber kind of finale. I would, you'd call that the finale, the high point of the end of the third act. Everything after that is a kind of coda. But there's an Iraqi guy, and he's been forced to wear a bomb, and he's sent out, and Renner and co have got to go and see to him. That scene is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And it's the first time you've seen a ticking clock with a bomb, which, going back to Hollywood tropes, whenever you see a bomb, there's always a ticking clock.
Yeah.
And you've seen Renner's disarmed so many bombs by snipping the wires, and there's been all these kind of cool different iterations of that. And then at the very end, the final bomb has a ticking clock, which you don't really see, but you're told that there is a ticking clock. And it's just, it's
which makes it scarier that you don't see the time.
Yeah. I mean, Bigelow, she's a fucking hell of a director. It is a superbly put together film. And it's just everything spot on, decisions like that. And
can I say one thing about that scene quickly before you move on?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I'm not going to move on. I'm just going to say that scene is better than anything in Jarhead, just pure entertainment wise. And it's totally earned it. And you kind of go out, despite the really shit coda, you go out on a slightly higher high after Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
As a result.
I mean, emotionally as well, it is. There's a moment when Jeremy Renner realizes that there's not enough time left on the ticking clock. There's too many padlocks. The bolt cutters aren't working. He's not going to be able to save this man. And he's kind of apologizing to him, but while he's telling him to calm down, he puts his hand out on the back of the man's head, and the man pushes his head back into the hand. And it's this incredible moment of like human interaction in the middle of panic. Still, it makes me cry when I watch that bit. I think it's very moving. But you're right, the film then goes on. Anyway, I was going to suggest maybe jumping ahead a little bit into a different subcategory, because I think you've already started to touch on it with Jarhead, and I'd love to hear more. This subheading is satire. Now, I think Jarhead is a bit of a satire of American soldiers' experience in war. And I say that because, you know, the funny thing about this film is that the whole film is them preparing to go to war, getting ready, becoming obsessed with the idea of killing and really submitting themselves to the propaganda of the war effort. But when they get there, the war's over before they can even shoot their guns. And that's, you know, the film does this lovely job of sort of shooting itself in the dick, you know?
But then also, you know, the gear doesn't work.
Yeah.
They get shot by friendly fire. Yeah. No one gets killed by an enemy. Someone gets shot in training by an American soldier. Yeah. They get killed by enemy fire. It's a deeply cynical, deeply satirical, deeply, 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 truly, madly, deeply, a deeply satirical film. Yeah. And I imagine that is another reason why it didn't do very well. Hurt Locker, to be fair, is also fairly cynical and cocks a snook at the powers that be. It's got like a kind of a punk rock individualist kind of streak, again, which would appeal to a certain kind of viewer. And it gets away with both having that and then also but not being unpatriotic at the same time.
Yeah.
It loves the troops. It loves the men.
Yeah.
So yeah, they're both good in that regard.
Well, there's a funny scene in Jarhead where all the soldiers are sat watching the flight of the Valkyries, you know? And there's a sort of irony within this anyway, because they're cheering it on. They're very excited about it. They're all really loud. Jake Gyllenhaal does this really funny, over-the-top emotional acting response to the film, so you can almost see that like they've been told to to turn it to 11 a little bit, like the audience almost being let in on the joke. And then the film is interrupted before the explosions can begin by their boss coming in and telling them, oh, they're going to war, which is basically foreshadowing the end of their own journey as well, right? Everything stops before any of the explosions begin. The war doesn't make any sense. Their ability to interact with the war doesn't make any sense. They don't know why they're there. Audiences can't engage with it either because there's no clarity or purpose or narrative to the film. It's just, these are the men that are there and this is what happens to them when they're there. Now, do you want to play the box office game?
Yes, I'd love to play. Yeah, we're going to have to play these back to back, which isn't ideal.
I think I'd prefer to start with The Hurt Locker, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, you see, you watched these in the wrong order.
Yeah, I did.
Okay, I watched these. It was always Jarhead first and Hurt Locker was the adjunct.
Yeah.
And not only that, Jarhead comes out in 2005 first and Hurt Locker comes out second in 2008.
Okay.
You decided, even though you were trying to pull my pants down about Hurt Locker, yep, and how good it was and how it's not a forgot, you decided to watch that first, knowing you loved it first, just so to kind of put on a little suit of armour for when you watched Jarhead. you're already kind of you've immunised yourself from just watching Jarhead and going... Yeah,
no.
That's, you fucked it. Listen, if you'd watched Jarhead first, if you'd watched Jarhead first, you might have actually been surprised and thought it was better.
The deep irony of what you're saying now, which is to say that you're telling me that I fucked it ahead of time by believing a thing about a thing, is exactly what you're doing now. You fucked it because you're believing a thing about a thing. It's not a thing. And the thing it's about isn't a thing either.
I do think there's something interesting about if you watch two films in a week and they're the same in the same ball
house. I watch them within 24 hours.
Same ball house?
Same ball house, for sure, yeah.
Same wheelhouse.
Same ball house,
same wheelhouse.
Absolutely.
The one you see first, it's gonna be a slightly maybe higher in your estimation. You know, your thirst for the second is going to be diminished because of familiarity.
If anything, the fact that I watched The Hurt Locker first made me excited to watch Jarhead because I wanted more, you know?
So anyway, I don't mind you doing Hurt Locker first, but obviously I do.
Fine. Well, let's go with Jarhead first then. Now, would you like to guess? And we're going to do this. No, fuck it. We're going to do them exactly at the same time. That's what we're going to do. Okay. What I want from you is to guess the budget for Jarhead and the budget for Hurt Locker, please. Start with Jarhead.
Hurt Locker, please. Uh-huh. What is a Hurt Locker?
I don't know. I think it's like it always makes me think of what did they call that in Matilda? That cupboard with the nails that you used to have to get in.
The Hurt Locker.
No, it wasn't called the Hurt Locker, it was called the Chokey. The Chokey. It makes me think of the Chokey from Matilda. I assume it's like that.
I think it's more like it hits you right in the Hurt Locker.
Let's have a look. What is a Hurt Locker?
I think it's something like, it's that you got hit in the Hurt Locker, a place where you'd get
well.
Hurt,
Hurt Locker,
like, it's the trunk.
It is a slang term for a place of deep pain and discomfort.
Right. Yeah. So I've got a real Hurt Locker.
Oh, it's U.S. military slang. First emerged during the Vietnam War. One of the earliest uses appeared in an Associated Press article by John Wheeler. If an army marches on its stomach, old Charlie is in the Hurt Locker, with Charlie being a nickname for the Viet Cong.
It's nice that no one in the movie said, oh man, I got right shit goddamn in the Hurt Locker.
It is nice. But again, not everything's in the text.
Jarhead is going to be... It's got some really big stuff in.
There's a lot of big stuff in everything.
Big stuff, and it's Mendy's.
Mendy's nuts.
But he's not covered him. He didn't make a lot of money with Road to Perdition. He would have got a big old budget on that.
It's Fox. It's Gyllenhaal. It's the Saudi Arabian desert, or probably it's not. But you know,
Fox isn't big back then. Neither is Gyllenhaal.
Gyllenhaal.
Let's say it cost $50 million.
Okay, and what about the Hurt Locker?
The Hurt Locker. This is also interesting because it doesn't have the scope of Jarhead, does Hurt Locker.
No.
It feels like a lot smaller a film.
It's set pieces, for sure.
But it's got the set pieces, but you really just, in terms of just characters, you only just see three guys. There is no scale or scope.
Well,
and I'm not saying that as a dig.
There's Ralph Fiennes. There's also, what's his name? Mr. Morse.
That's the scene. No. I don't mean in terms of actors. I mean, like, I'm talking about, like...
Story scope, sprawl, yeah.
Sprawl, yeah. Like, you know, in Zulu, when you get all the...
So you think it's smaller?
It feels smaller. Yeah. And so I'm saying maybe it could have been made for not a lot. And I think up to Hurt Locker, these films hadn't made a lot of money.
Uh-huh.
Bigelow hasn't made a film in a while. She's a woman. She's a woman. So she's getting a woman money. She's not getting men money. See, now this is me being satirical. Yeah. And I just need to spell that out. So
50 million for Jarhead.
It's insane to think, now I'm saying it out loud, that Jarhead cost more money, but I think it did. And I'm going to say, did they cost the same amount of money? They feel like, also there's only 3 years difference. Oh shit. 60 million for Jarhead, 50 million for Hurt Locker.
Well, now you are right. In the sense that Jarhead cost more money. Jarhead cost $72 million.
Oh, I'm really glad I bumped it up to 60.
Yeah, very close.
But not close
with the Hurt Locker. The Hurt Locker cost $15 million.
That is nuts. Yeah. I knew.
Significant.
It's
five times cheaper.
It was so much. It's small.
Yeah, it's small.
It is small.
Yeah, it's small for sure.
That's an amazing return.
Well, we shall see. Next up is opening weekend, US and Canada, please. I'd like a guess for Jarhead and then for The Hurt Locker.
When's Hurt Locker coming out?
So Hurt Locker comes out in June, middle of the summer, and Jarhead comes out in November, obviously 3 years earlier, 2005.
Jarhead's not making anything. It's making $500,000.
Okay. Okay, and The Hurt Locker, how much is that making?
I don't think it's opening. I think it's got legs. I don't know.
This is very interesting to play two at the same time.
It's actually going to make me change my Jarhead.
The audience won't know this, but we will have cut out many of the pauses. Adam's having a good old think about this because it's difficult.
Okay, so Jarhead costs 70. So Jarhead makes 5 million and Hurt Locker makes a million.
Are we acknowledging to the audience that you've upped your Jarhead guess?
I upped Jarhead from 500 grand.
To 5 million. Opening weekend for Jarhead, November 6th, 2005, $27,726.
Shit.
It's very successful.
Really?
On the opening weekend. Yeah.
That's very successful. I mean, in Mendy's book, it suggests that Jarhead was a failure.
Well, maybe it still will be. We yet to do gross worldwide. Let me tell you that opening weekend, US and Canada, for The Hurt Locker, halfway through June, $145,000. Very modest indeed. Yes.
Because, Joe. Marketing budget.
Because.
Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
Hurt Locker's only, it's cost $50 million. They don't have the marketing and they're not going to, it's not got the presence. Jarhead, they've spent 70 on it.
Agree.
You sure as hell they're going to market the fuck out of
it. Later it wins the Best Picture Oscar.
From the director of American Beauty.
Yeah. Well, and now, gross worldwide, Jarhead first and then The Hurt Locker. Quick reminder that Jarhead did 28 mil opening weekend. What do you think it did gross worldwide?
Let's say it cleaned its face and made, I mean, it's not cleaning its face if it only makes 90. I reckon it maybe made 90 mil, which means it's probably losing money because after all that marketing money.
And The Hurt Locker, please.
Hurt Locker.
145K opening weekend.
Yeah, but I mean, it's up for Oscars, mate.
Yeah, but it's not up for Oscars in June.
No, but it's going to be in the cinemas. They'll bring it back for cinemas.
Will they bring it back? Would it run all the second half of the year.
Yeah, why not?
Well, I don't know. Is that how it normally works?
But then it's going to get a worldwide release and it's going to do really well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, certainly when it comes to the UK, we went to see it because it was up for, you know, Oscar nom.
True. True.
Well, I don't know now. Okay, let's say it made 80 million.
Okay. So for Jarhead you said 90. Within 10%, my friend, it made $97 million gross worldwide.
Yes.
Well done.
Thank God for that.
Hurt Locker, you're a little further away. You said $80 million. It made $49 million overall. Yeah. But I think it's cleaning its face, you know.
That's closer to what I said its budget was.
I think it's making money.
Oh, it's made money.
It's made money hand over fist.
Should we do the game, the bit in the podcast where we do the game where one of us reads out a list of movies they think the other person has forgot they forgot?
Yes, please.
In the hope of catching them out so we can do next week's film.
Yes, I'm going to fucking get you, man. I've got a really good list.
You always get me. If you didn't get me, there'd be no show.
Yeah, but just let me feel good about it.
But you've plumbed me loads, mate. Yeah. You've plumbed
Listen,
me.
Do you have any idea how, after the end of an hour and a half of talking to you and not always being able to get you in the conversation, yeah, I'm guaranteed a get at the end because you have to say yes, you've forgotten one of these films. That's the only reason I wanted to do this podcast was for you to have to publicly declare to me once every other week that you had in fact forgotten this film. I love it. It's what I live for, and I'm about to breathe some excellent forgettable movies at you. Are you ready?
But I've never really forgotten them. Let's be clear. I've only kind of, sort of, I've forgotten them. But
this is one that's going to come back to you. I'm not actually suggesting it now for obvious reasons, but I'm definitely going to get you with it in about, you know, 15 films time. The film Vice, which was suggested by Cass Vandalar in an email, the listener, it's unfortunately, it's very related to the Iraq and Afghanistan war, so I don't think we're going to back-to-back that shit.
I think we agreed I'd say yes to it, even though I've only seen half of it.
Half of it, okay. But I'll get you with that at some point.
Yeah.
But here's my first real one. And I feel like this is a get, man. I think it's a get. The Martian.
It's a good... It would be good for our numbers, but...
Do you actually remember that?
I mean, I know, but I forgot it because the front cover of it, and like, I can't, there's bits of it I remember, like him, the shit and the potatoes, and it's a deeply forgettable film, but it feels like it's not a forgot you forgotter.
Really?
Do you think it is a forgot you forgotter?
I think it was, it sold itself as the biggest film of the year that it came out in. And since then, almost no one has thought about it.
I feel like it's always like swirling around the toilet bowl.
Is it?
The thing is, if I let you get me on this, you're going to go away all happy, and I don't.
I tell you what, I'll give you three more, and if I don't get you on the other three, we'll circle back to The Martian.
Okay.
Okay. Here's my other ones now, Mr. Turner.
Never seen it.
Oh, it's a beautiful film.
Are you talking about it because old Ricky Young was just watched it?
English Ricky?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. No, I watched it in the cinema.
Apparently you just watched it with his...
Did he recommend it to you?
He doesn't recommend anything. He just said he'd seen it.
Yeah.
But it made me think I should see that because I do like Mike Lee, yeah, and I haven't seen anything of his post Topsy Turvy.
It's a wonderful film. I really liked it. Okay, two more. Loser. The American Pie shoot-off. Not real shoot-off. Loser. The film that everyone's actually forgotten, but it's only people haven't forgotten it because of the song Teenage Dirtbag and the music video.
I'm just vetoing that.
Why?
We're not doing that.
But we could talk about American Pie.
I don't want to talk about American Pie.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you know, I think that was a sort of like quite big, you know, turn of the 21st century sort of, you know, genre of movie?
I do, but I despise the time. I despise the aesthetic. I despise...
Fair enough. You're older than me. Maybe you came to those films at a different age. I mean, you did come to those films at a different age.
Mate, I came to those films. No, American Pie was... Loser was after that, but American Pie was when I was 17, 18. So
I'm pretty plum
for me. Yeah. So I'm now, you know, look back and with disgust.
Yep. Yep.
In outrage.
Okay, fair enough. Let me pick carefully. I'm not going to... No.
Oh, look at that. All his wins have gone out of his sails now. He's not so fucking cocky now, is he? He doesn't want to have to go back to the Martian scrubbing around for scraps, but he's going to have to. He's going to have to.
All right, in which case I'll have to say a film that you haven't seen just to bring your spirits down a little. Anomalisa.
I have seen that.
Had you forgotten it?
Not really.
Really?
I think the end joke, I just thought it was bad. I didn't think it was a very good film.
I don't want to rewatch it anyway.
The end joke is amazing. There's an amazing joke at the end of that. But let's go back and let's do The Martian.
Look, one more. I'll get you with one more, okay?
It feels like you give...
Foxcatcher.
Never seen it.
Oh, fuck's sake, man. These are prime films.
They're not.
You have to watch Foxcatcher, okay?
I don't want to see Steve Carell with a fake nose, and I hate Channing Tatum.
All right, a couple more. The film Wild with Reese Witherspoon.
I mean, there's a bit of that I really remember. A very saucy bit.
Oh, I remember the bit where she puts the purifier tablet into the stagnant water.
I remember really liking it. I can't remember anything.
Yep. I think I've got you with it.
I mean, it's wilderness. I guess it's a female story. We haven't done female stories.
It is that.
It's Reese Witherspoon. Yep.
It's Big Reese.
Oh, yeah, okay, fine. Yeah, get me on Wild.
Yes, yes. Oh, it stings. I got you.
So, that was the special Jarhead Hurt Locker episode. You have been listening to the Movies You Forgot podcast. See you next week with Wild. Say bye, Joe.
Bye. Oh, bye.
It's always funny when you do that.